You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On a foggy day in August 2003, Grace and Lily Pearson took their very first plane ride in their uncle's Beechcraft Baron. Weather conditions on the day weren't ideal for flying, but their uncle had plenty of experience. However, soon into the plane ride, Lily noticed the trees growing closer and closer. The horrific accident claimed the life of their mother, Catherine Pearson, and her brother-in-law, the pilot, Charlie Erickson. Although they were badly injured, the girls miraculously survived the plane crash. But for their grief-stricken father, Toby Pearson, the nightmare of loss, injury, and an insurance company that didn't want to pay for his loss was only just the beginning. Former BBC correspondent and journalist Damien Fowler tells that story in a book called Falling Through Clouds. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Fowler to our show today. Hello.
Hello, good to be here.
Plane crashes happen all the time. Why did you follow this story in particular?
Well, there was something particular about the image of the two girls lost in the forest that seemed almost kind of like a fairy tale that caught my attention. And that in and of itself perhaps wasn't enough. But then when I heard the other part of the story, which was the fact that there was this legal battle that was involved after the fact, and that Toby Pearson and his daughters became a target, defendants in a case against the pilot's insurance company, that intrigued me. So those two things together somehow like led me to investigate further.
And we'll get to the girls in the forest and the suit by the insurance company against the survivor in a little while. But let's back up. Where were Grace, Lily, and Catherine Pearson flying to that day?
They were flying for a Labor Day weekend party for their grandpa's, I think it was his 70th birthday party, up to Grand Marais. Well, they were flying to Grand Marais, which is up on Lake Superior on the North Shore, some five-hour drive from the Twin Cities. But from there, they were then intending to drive up something called the Gunflint Trail to the border area between Minnesota and Canada, where they had this incredible lodge, cabin. Everyone in Minnesota seems to have a cabin. On a lake, Lake Saganaga. I've never managed to say that correctly, and Minnesotans tried to correct me. So they were going up to this lake for this...
Most of those lakes, by the way, were created during mining. They're not natural lakes.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
But as I understand it, I'm sure somebody's going to write in and say, Lopate, you idiot. That's not true. But
well, it's the land of 10,000 lakes, yes. So the percentage of them
must
be... In fact,
the Los Angeles Lakers began in Minnesota.
Yeah. So that's where they were heading. So, yeah, they were heading into this... It's a little airport. I mean, it's a fixed-based operator. It doesn't have an air traffic control. So they were flying in on a very cloudy day, and that's when things went wrong.
It was the very first time Grace and Lily had flown in a plane. How old were they?
At the time, they were 3 and 4. Lily was 3 and Grace was 4.
Why wasn't their father, Toby Pearson, flying with the family?
Well, he had work to do back in the Twin Cities, so the idea was that his wife, Catherine, and the two children would go up ahead as a sort of little thrill. They'd go on their uncle's plane, Charlie Erickson's plane.
And you say he was very experienced.
He was experienced. He'd bought the plane... many years. Well, he'd been flying for many years because he had businesses. He had a business that required him to go out to Iowa, I believe, and it helped that he had a plane. This particular plane, the Beechcraft Baron, he had much less experience in this plane, so he had what they call low air time in it. It was a heavier plane.
Beechcraft Barons have a good safety record?
I think they do. I mean, I don't know the facts off the top of my head. But generally, it's a twin-prop plane. It's not a single-propeller plane. The single-propeller planes that are more familiar to people when we talk about private planes, they're the ones with the more, shall we say, they're more characteristically dangerous than the Beechcraft Baron. The Beechcraft Baron requires someone to be a more experienced pilot, so generally... they're not involved in as many accidents.
Although most plane accidents in this country involve private planes.
That's true, yeah. A very high percentage, in fact. I think the National Transportation Safety Board found that 94% of fatal aviation accidents occurred in what's called general aviation. And that's a very, obviously very high percentage.
When Charlie Erickson's plane missed an approach to land at Grand Marais Airport, and why didn't the air traffic controller, Rod Roy, radio back to see what happened?
Well, he was in touch with them through the intercom. It wasn't they were talking to each other, and then typically he explained to me when a pilot doesn't come back to him, it means that the pilot has flown on to the next airport. He explained that in a situation like that, when a pilot cannot see the runway to finish his approach in instrument condition, what they call instrument conditions. Because there were a lot of clouds, they would typically, you know, either go back to where they came from or fly on to a nearby airport so they can land safely. On this case, he didn't hear back from the pilot, so he assumed that the pilot must have moved on, gone to the next airport. So that was his immediate assumption.
Who was the first to raise the alarm that there may have been an accident?
The plane has a signal that when it goes down or has a bumpy landing, sets off a basic alarm, not an alarm, but a kind of I don't know what you would call it. It has a special term, but it's
like an emergency beacon.
An emergency beacon, exactly. So that went off, and I think the Minnesota Civil Air Guard picked it up, and at that point, then people started to get, you know, warned that there was a possible crash in the forest, though they didn't know for sure.
Although it's not always so easy to pinpoint the location of the crash, even with that emergency beacon. You raise a couple of possible causes for the accident, including spatial disorientation. Now, wasn't the plane on automatic pilot? Shouldn't the plane have been able to get past spatial disorientation?
Well, as it turned out, spatial disorientation is one of the key killers for general aviation pilots. But in this instance, I believe that the reason the plane crashed was to do with a stall, which is another common accident pattern that pilots have. And that goes to the point of the plane being a heavier plane. And so the pilot was probably under power. And as he did his go-around through the clouds, he probably didn't have enough power. We can speculate here. He probably didn't have enough power, and the plane would have, as somebody put it to me, dropped out of the sky like a brick.
Because the only witnesses here are two very young children who probably weren't the best at finding out or revealing what happened.
They could reveal after the fact sort of sensations, traveling down a bumpy road, they described it. They actually said falling through clouds. So they were aware of some kind of incident, some kind of panic even. And later on, the adults, and the father, Toby Pearson, and everyone tried to kind of find out what did they know, what did they see. And it was, they were just a little bit too young to really be reliable witnesses. In fact, it was one of the challenges of doing the book too, because I couldn't interview them really to go there. And in fact, I was discouraged from doing so because pediatric psychologists didn't want me to sort of get that whole trauma.
You know, how old are they now?
Again. Now they're 13 and 14.
Did you go to the Superior National Forest?
I did, yeah.
And you say crashing a plane there is just as bad as disappearing in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Why is it so difficult for search and rescue to locate plane wreckage in the forest?
Well, it's 3 million acres. It's vast. And there are peaks and valleys. And so this fact came to me from a local pilot, Dan Anderson, who was, in fact, the man who found them, who located the girls in the forest. And Dan's a local figure in Grand Marais. And, in fact, he takes people up on small plane rides, and they can go and spot moose and wolves. So Dan had been present over the years at a number of incidents where planes had gone down and it had taken many years to find them. In fact, he recounted one to me, and it was 15, 20 years later before they actually found the wreckage. So it seems remarkable that to me, but I guess the forest is so dense and there aren't trails to, you know, there are logging trails, but that's it. It's really kind of wilderness out there.
And he told he told the rescue team to bring only body bags because he assumed everybody had died. The crash was so horrific. My guest is Damien Fowler, who's written a book called Falling Through Clouds, a story of survival, love, and liability. It is published by St. Martin's Press. People have described Grace and Lily's survival as an act of God, but aren't children statistically more likely to survive a plane crash?
Some people have asserted that children are more likely to survive, but there's no definitive science on that.
Why would that even be the case?
Well, some people speculated that children are often strapped in the back, perhaps. They're not in the cockpit where adults, you know, where their mother was with the pilot. So they were in the back. So there's that factor. Maybe something to do with aerodynamics. I don't know. It seems like something that could be explored. I did look into it, but really came up with no satisfactory answer.
It was important that the girls decided to stay with the plane wreck instead of venturing into the forest. Had they been instructed to do something like that?
Not explicitly, but one of the things I try to bring out in the book is they had this very good parenting from Catherine and Toby, and they were, I guess, taught to look after each other and encouraged to be independent-minded. And they were, by all accounts, quite the older girl. Grace was very mature for her age, so somehow she had some preternatural understanding that it wasn't a good idea to leave the wreckage.
Into the forest and get lost.
Right, but she also had enough sense to pull her sister away from the fire. This came out in the interviews after the crash, and she said at a press conference, "I got her away from the fire. I protected her." And this was a four-year-old speaking to the press corps in Minnesota, who were kind of stunned. It's not something you'd expect from a four-year-old. So maybe it's a combination of good parenting, but many people wanted to ascribe it to an act of God. They were miracle kids in the paper, and so that was...
And they were listed as the lucky ones in a list of lucky people. They came in second behind a lotto winner, which really had to upset their father, because nobody was lucky here. The girls had been hurt, and they'd lost their mother.
Yeah, the end of the year after this whole... Toby was nursing the girls back to health, and Lily, the younger one, had been very badly burned. 50-60% of her body had been burned, third-degree burns, in the fire of the crash. But they'd survived. So this end-of-year roundup for, I think it was the Pioneer Press, wanted to kind of write this piece about people who'd been fortunate. But their unfortunate use of the word lucky didn't go down well with Toby, who he got this call and they said, "We want to name you the second luckiest person of the year." And he shook his head in disbelief and said, "Well, why am I lucky?" And they said, "Well, because your daughter survived." But he also said, "Well, my wife died too. So, you know, let's balance it." So then I think he softened his tone a bit and he understood what they were after. You know, they were after trying to kind of make sense of this remarkable story. So...
How long did it take for Lily to recover with all of those burns?
Well, there were two stages. I mean, there's the physical recovery. There were three stages. There was the critical element for the first few weeks. Would she or would she not survive? Because the degree of burns that she had suggested that she could have died from infection. Anyway, she made it through that after intensive, you know, skin grafting and a lot of care from a burn specialist at the Regions Hospital in Minnesota. Once she made it through that stage, there were many other elements. She had to wear a facial mask, an orthotic mask, to stop the scarring on the face, and she had to wear that for 18 months. So that was all part of the healing process. But at least she wasn't in mortal danger at that point.
It's lucky that she was young and didn't have to go to school with that kind of thing. But she'd lost a mother, and both of the girls had to go, had incredible medical costs, I imagine. Do we know how much?
Well, People magazine in 2005 has speculated that it was sort of upwards of $850,000. This is like a year and a half after the accident.
Was health insurance there? Did it cover that?
They had health insurance, but as anyone knows with health insurance, there are all these extra costs. Plus, Toby had lost a wage earner, another wage earner in his family. Plus, he couldn't work. He was working part-time. And there were many other extra costs that he incurred. So
he was hoping for a payout from Charlie Erickson's insurance company.
The goal was, I mean, the kind of, if there was anything reassuring about it, he knew that there was a fairly substantial liability policy on the plane. So he was reassured by lawyers that that money would be coming to them for claims, for coverage, for bodily injury, for wrongful death, and the kind of claims that you would automatically expect to come from such a policy.
What did the insurance company, Old Republic, say when they denied Toby Pearson's claim and then included Toby and his daughters in a complaint against them in a federal court suit? The insurance company sued him for what reason?
Well, they claim that the insurance policy that Charlie Erickson had, the pilot, was void. Void because they found on the policy that Charlie had allegedly made a material misrepresentation. In other words, they claimed, lied about some facts on his form. Now, after the fact, when they're due to pay out, they went back to that form and found this misrepresentation. Because of that, it's a contractual breach. So they sued essentially the estate, the pilot's estate, and also had to name Toby and the daughters in that suit because they were claimants against the liability policy.
Now, another venue Toby might have taken was to sue the Erickson estate for damages, but he didn't take that route.
Well, the interesting and slightly delicate thing about that was that the Erickson estate, the pilot, Charlie, was married to Catherine's sister, so that it was the girl's uncle. So it was an potentially intra-family dispute, and that would have been an awful mess. And I think Toby's wisdom led him to try to mitigate this whole thing, this big mess, without getting involved in a lawsuit against the other side of the family, even as he was quite angry about what had happened.
Well, this got a lot of attention nationally. People magazine wrote about it. Others, it couldn't have been good PR for Old Republic.
Not at all. No, I think people, apparently there was one anecdote where people were emailing the company so intensively that it crashed their server. But I don't know, that sounds like a mythical tale. But for sure, yeah, no one likes it. A bad guy insurance company, and these guys were definitely the Goliath in this Goliath and David battle.
Considering the fact that Charlie had paid all of his insurance premiums, would have assumed that there would have been a payout in case of a crash.
Well, there's a quote by Mark Twain or something about insurance companies and bankers who, they're the kind of people who lend you the umbrella when it's the sun is shining, but as soon as it starts to rain, they want it back. And it was that kind of scenario.
Well, the Old Republic still did have a case. What happened when it went to court?
Well, the Old Republic kept their argument was that it was a breach of contract and that there was no public, there was no nothing on statute to require them to do this. They stuck to the law, regardless of the emotional elements of this potential case. They argued that they had no right. Charlie had breached the policy, and therefore, sorry, you're not going to get a penny. That set the stage for this potential trial.
Had Charlie Erickson lied when he filled out the insurance form?
Well, Toby's lawyer suggested that, it could have been a mistake, and he wasn't around to be deposed. But it did appear to be the case, yeah.
Although the insurance company would have had in its own records the real facts because it involved a previous claim.
Exactly, yeah. They had on file this previous claim, which they had paid out on and subsequently bumped his insurance premiums. they didn't connect the two dots when he filed the second policy for the Beechcraft Baron.
Well, but the court decided in favor of Toby against the insurance company.
The court found, yeah, that there was enough evidence that they didn't rule on the public policy element of it, but they found that there was enough doubt to what the insurance company wanted was summary judgment. They wanted the whole thing thrown out. The court hearing allowed Toby to proceed to trial, essentially. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody really wanted a trial, neither the insurance company nor Toby. He didn't want to put his daughters through that kind of horror show, in a way. But the insurance company also knew it wouldn't look good for them to be up against 4- and 5-year-old girl at this stage.
So they settled.
Yeah.
They could have done it a lot earlier and saved a lot of money in the process.
They could have, instead of dragging Toby through 2 to 3 years of what he describes as a kind of hell.
And Toby got his revenge in a way by encouraging the Minnesota state legislature to pass a law that wouldn't allow something like this to happen again?
What he found is when he looked into it was that whilst there was public policy in Minnesota that said that required an insurance company, an aviation insurance company, to pay out on a claim involving a no avoidance for fraud clause, there was nothing on statute, and that was what the insurance company argued. So he held their feet to the fire and said third parties, such as, you know, his daughters, should not be have anything to do, should not get in between an insurer and the insured. I'm getting a bit technical, but it's really he didn't want to. He wanted the idea that third parties should be exempt from any kind of legal wranglings between the two parties. And essentially, what happened is they created a law that allowed an insurance company to not wriggle out of its contract if it could only wriggle out of the contract if there was a direct connection from the lie to the accident. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but does this apply only to Minnesota, or if a similar thing had occurred in upstate New York or in Florida or Texas or California, whatever, would we be seeing similar court cases?
Potentially, yeah. I mean, there's no this was done on a state level. It was done for Minnesota level. So each state regulates its own insurance, its own aviation insurance.
Which is more on a third party is now more like third party insurance on a motor vehicle. But even though we're talking about planes, which are quite different than motor vehicles.
Exactly. There's an interesting fact that as I researched this story, I found that, well, I followed the story. Toby, after he passed this law in Minnesota to hold insurance companies accountable for third-party claims, regardless of the fraud element of a claim, just as in motor vehicles, wanted to do it on a federal level. But then he found that there was no federal requirement for general aviation pilots to have any insurance whatsoever, depending on the state, but there's no federal requirement. So it depends on the state. It's a regulatory patchwork.
And it would have been different if this had happened in Canada, where there is a national law.
There is, and the mandatory minimums, as they're called, are much higher in Canada. I think there are $300,000 per seat, you know, for any incident. Whereas I think Toby managed to get them up to $100,000. But before he passed the law, it was the insurance company had a minimum of $25,000 per seat, which is hardly adequate given the costs for, you know, that kind of catastrophic injury.
Would it have been different if they had been in a commercial airplane?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The federal rules for planes are quite different from general aviation, which is governed under some regulations called Part 91 to Part 121, which are commercial airlines. And those are regulated and insured intensively. There's all sorts of coverage for major air carriers and, any carrier that has to operate for money, for profit.
Damien Fowler has written for Vanity Fair, Vogue, The Guardian, The Financial Times Magazine, The Times of London, among others. He is a former BBC reporter, And his book is Falling Through Clouds, A Story of Survival, Love, and Liability. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.